Welcome to Cyprus Untold, the unbiased and unprecedented podcast taking you inside the last 50 years of the United Nations buffer zone. Your host is Samuel Lewis Blanc, production by Ceasefire Limited. Os Geldin, Cali Athiris. Welcome back, listeners. I hope you enjoyed part one of this saga of an episode exploring Cyprus between 1951 and 1960. We're going to dive straight into this second part where we left off. Again, please be advised there will be some upsetting scenes during this part of the episode. And sorry, I cannot cover every story. I know many have been shared already on social media. Do continue to engage on this, but with respect for each other and without prejudice. Thank you. April the 1st, 1955. It's a day considered widely in the history books as the day that EOCA, their campaign to unseat the British from ruling Cyprus, begins. The confusion for some in taking this view is that whilst they did set about laying explosives in a number of British-controlled installations, namely the radio headquarters in Nicosia, police stations in Larnaca, Limassol and Famagusta, nobody was killed during these attacks, and due to the group being unknown at this time, the attacks were passed off by the British authorities as attempts for publicity by a communist party called ACAL. But it did not take long before EOCA would be known, it would be feared, and would be attributed to the bombings of April 1st, 1955. Marco Dracu, a 23-year-old Greek Cypriot member of the group, would be synonymous with EOCA's rise to prominence on the island during that summer of 55. Nicknamed Billy the Bomber, his tactic of choice was to throw grenades into shops or static vehicles where groups of British tourists, military personnel, or their families frequented. Most notably, from British reports at least, he is known for the first killing of British soldiers when he threw a grenade into the back of the military Land Rover. So revered for his actions and subsequent part in forcing a political settlement for Cyprus, there is actually a street named after him in central Nicosia. It's just outside the Paphos Gate of the old Venetian city walls, running north towards Ledger Palace and the Turkish Cypriot checkpoint. At the top of the road, there's a roundabout, and in the middle of the roundabout, there's a monument for Marco. I will put a Google Maps link on Instagram to the location and an image so you can see this for yourselves. The monument is Marco Dracu stood with his arms raised, pointing with his left hand forward and in his right a grenade behind him as if he is about to launch another deadly assault. I wonder how many Cypriots pass this on a daily basis and actually know what it's referencing. I certainly know most tourists who will undoubtedly walk and drive through this area will have no idea what it is unless pointed out. I know for a fact most of the UN peacekeepers in the area pay lip service to this part of history that's right under their noses. And I can see partly why. It's due to the surrounding area of Marco Dracu Street. It's a live issue with regards to ceasefire lines, so we'll cover that later. The fact is, Nicosia is littered with busts and memorials for the 1950s EOCA members. It's quite an oddity, especially for British forces personnel now stationed on the island, especially those in the UN, as they are the ones who come into closer contact with the real history on a daily basis. The sovereign base areas take far less interest in the history, as far as I'm concerned anyway. There is also the realpolitik of the situation that surrounding the sovereign base areas, Cypriot businesses rely much more on the bases for custom. Slight digression there, and I definitely want to explain that dynamic in much more detail later on. Let's get back to 1955. It's summer. There's been a wave of attacks against British forces British interests on the island, and many civilians are beginning to get caught up in the violence. Now, who could have guessed how the British authorities would react? Knowing your history of colonial rule at the time, and if you've already listened to the earlier episodes of the podcast about British reprisals in the 1930s due to the revolt on the island at the time, I'm going to give you a quick second to guess what is coming next. I'm sure you've all guessed correctly. The British do indeed react with a hard stick approach. However, they actually use the carrot as well. I hope my carrot and stick analogy is not lost on anyone. For the first time in Cyprus, since British rule of the island, talks between Turkey, Greece, the UK and Cypriot representatives led by Makarios are convened. Just to be clear, the original Liberation Committee that both Makarios and Grievous are leading was still unknown about to the authorities. The actions of Iocha, Makarios publicly denounces, and he claims no connection to the group. We might liken this to many other revolutionary groups throughout the 20th century trying to get away from the British Empire. Groups where they have a political faction and a paramilitary wing, trying to bring about the end of the British colonial rule, all while claiming no connection to one another. Now, the talks between the diplomats of each nation with interest in Cyprus fails to conclude anything tangible, and so the British appoint a new governor of Cyprus to try and quell what is seen from a Western point of view as terrorism. That appointee was Field Marshal Sir John Harding, a veteran of both world wars, but more importantly, he's the individual seen as having the greatest experience with counterinsurgency. He had been in command of land forces during the Malayan emergency of the late 1940s, and he was an advisor to the UK government responding to the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya. Now, he set about immediately to engage with Makarios. He, like others, thought that Makarios could reach out to the Iocha leaders, perhaps speak on a religious level, appeal to their shared Greek Cypriot heritage. Harding actually went as far as offering a multi-million pound deal to develop the island further and give Cypriots greater self-governance. All he wanted in return was a postponement for calls of self-determination and an end to Iocha attacks. Makarios, of course, declined. And when attending this next secret meeting of the Iocha leadership, Grievous reportedly responded to Makarios describing Harding's intentions by stating, "Enosis or death." Shortly after Harding's failed attempts to convince Makarios to support a quick and peaceful solution to the end of the violence, a state of emergency was declared in Cyprus. Public assemblies were banned, the death penalty for carrying a weapon was introduced, and strikes were made illegal. Furthermore, an additional 300 British policemen were deployed to the island, and any Iocha sympathisers within the police, civil service or contractors were purged in mass dismissals. So what about the Turkish Cypriots during this period? The British actually turned to them for help in intelligence gathering efforts. But the calls for Enosis, the ostracising of Turkish Cypriots who worked for the British, and the civilian killings that were now mounting meant the communities had begun to split, neither trusting one another with information. In fact, it's during this period that we begin to see the two ethnically divide into communal hubs, where once streets were a mix of Turkish and Greek Cypriots, no consideration whatsoever for choosing neighbours based on ethnicity, relative harmony considering the age, but now starting to congregate and bind together so as not to get caught in crossfire battles or be mistaken as pro-Iocha or pro-British. Whilst Iocha in the early days of their campaign did make efforts to send letters to the Turkish communities stating their conflict was not aimed at them, there was an inevitable backlash and increasing divide on the horizon. Meanwhile, Iocha continued to wage its campaign of violent revolt. Up until December 1955 alone, Ioka carried out 104 bombings of domestic homes, incited 53 riots, conducted 136 acts of sabotage, 400 ambushes against police and military patrols, 35 individual assaults on policemen, 38 fatal attacks on soldiers, and 43 raids of police stations. Devastating numbers there for a relatively short space of time, but it gets worse. In 1956, Makarios is under increasing suspicion and is eventually exiled to the Seychelles. Not a bad place to be exiled to, let's be honest. Along with other suspected co-conspirators, not directly linked with Ioka terrorist activity, but implicit with the violence that continues to be waged in Cyprus. This enrages much of the Greek Cypriot population who, even if they are not supporters of Ioka, many were by the way, the vast majority, they're still pro-Enosis, and Makarios, he's the very visible leader of that movement, and the media, the propaganda if you like, depending on your viewpoint, is helping to drive this narrative that the peaceful bishop, a spiritual leader of the Greek Cypriots, is trying to bring about their right to self-determination. Yet it's the imperial colonists who are oppressing them, again as in the 1930s, and because it's witnessed around the world at the time, they're attempting to subdue other peaceful native peoples. Now, Harding, he attempts to combat this messaging with his own style of leaflet dropping and radio broadcasting. However, as with other attempts in Cyprus to sway Cypriots to British notions of rule, there's a huge language barrier. English is not spoken by most Cypriots, certainly not as their first language anyway, let alone reading or listening to it on the radio. Whereas the media and publications made by Ioka and the other political parties of Cyprus, they're humorous. They're conveyed in a captivating way that only other Cypriots would appreciate, and also those that are able to formulate it in the first instance. It's a great coup for Ioka looking back, and we with hindsight would obviously point out the absurd idea, the arrogance of the British establishment and Harding himself to think that this was a way to win the hearts and minds of the population. I think if you watch documentaries online in which Harding speaks of this time in Cyprus, you will understand the out-of-touch nature of the British field marshal and their ability to really understand the culture of another nationality. Personally, I've not even seen this change in recent history, and it's only the likes of T.E. Lawrence who could be argued as having ever achieved real cultural understanding and appreciation of another ethnic nationality to that of his own. The point is, Harding and the British are losing the narrative with Greek Cypriots. Diplomatically, they are resorting to expelling people with possible links with Ioka, and they are gradually creeping towards martial law. But let's not pass over the nature of Ioka's campaign of terror. Ioka begins in 1957, not only targeting the British, they actually start attacking Cypriots also. Any shops selling British goods are raided and looted, with the owners themselves being beaten. There are reports of savage attacks by pro-Ioka gangs in towns against anyone found smoking British-made cigarettes. One infamous case of execution carried out by Ioka, sadly there are too many to mention, a school teacher, a Greek Cypriot, is shot dead from behind in the cinema with his family, just because he has been publicly airing his pro-British affiliations. In another incident, a bus of tourists in Limassol, full of women and children, is attacked with grenades and shotguns. And for the British forces stationed on the island, one of the most notorious attacks which incites wide-scale condemnation, even internationally. The wife and daughter of the British Army sergeant are shot dead in broad daylight in Famagusta, whilst out shopping for a wedding dress. By this stage, 1957 to 58, I think it's fair to say that both Ioka
and the British authorities are losing control of the situation. It's not even a coordinated military operation any longer. Grievous's guerrilla tactics are turning more extreme and the British personnel react in kind. There are scenes of horrific mass fighting in towns where the British, seemingly in reprisal for the murder of Catherine Cutliffe and her daughter, one 17-year-old Greek Cypriot has his skull fatally split open by a rifle butt during one incident. And in another incident, a Turkish Cypriot child is run over by a military vehicle trying to escape a baying crowd of rioters. Other reports you will find online reveal similar stories of civilians caught in the crossfire of street battles. Ioka executions continue against anyone, regardless of gender, age, nationality or otherwise. If they are not pro-Enosis, or at a minimum anti-British, then there is a distinct possibility of being targeted. We could go down this road further, that there are claims of torture, hangings without trial, assassination attempts against Harding himself. However, I'm not wishing to dredge up any hateful feelings between the different factions. There is, of course, strong feelings still by all parties, even now, due to the nature of what happened during this period. We're simply trying to understand the context for the preceding events and how they come about due to this period of instability in Cyprus. So, if I may, I will move past the stories of violence during this time. There is unfortunately more to come in later episodes, even once independence is established, but we still need to get to that. In the meantime, I would like to end this section of the story with a poignant tale. When I first arrived on the island of Cyprus and I was learning about the challenging history, and I was coming across these monuments, these busts of the Ioka members, as I wandered around, with my family by the way, and having to explain the torrid history Brits had on the island. Another British soldier on our camp in Nicosia, he was having a christening for his son. It was taking place at the camp chapel, which itself has a rich history, having served as a place of worship exclusive for the British forces that originally lived on the base, and then years later it's come to serve all nationalities of the UN who now share some of the British facilities at the UN protected area. More on that challenge later. Now, the British soldier in question, whose son's christening it was, had been on the UN mission for some time, and he'd made a few local Cypriot friends, who he invited to the christening. When they were inside the chapel, they quite remarkably exclaimed to the British soldier, "Why do you have memorials on the walls here to terrorists?" Now, the only memorials on the walls of military chapels, this one included, are for the British and Commonwealth forces killed in defence of the realm. What on earth was this gentleman thinking? But of course, he politely explained that for his entire life, he had been brought up, taught that the British colonists were the terrorists. They were the ones oppressing the Cypriots and stealing their land. It was Ioka who were the freedom fighters and the liberators. Let's continue to discuss after the break. Powerful stuff there before the break, as well as some really disheartening stories. But it's all coming to a head politically very soon, you'll be thankful to hear. Before then, I just want to touch on the Turkish Cypriot side of 1955 to 58. And similar to part one, it will weave it back together in place for the crescendo in 1959. We mentioned previously the group Volkan, a Turkish Cypriot counterpart to the Cypriot Liberation Committee. They had reportedly been active since 1951 in some form or another opposing Enosis. Volkan's alternative vision was unity with Turkey, naturally. In fact, many in the group had the notion that if the British were to leave Cyprus, rule would naturally fall back to Turkey as the previous power in 1878. Of course, this wasn't an option for many political reasons, not to forget Atatürk's post-World War II declaration that Turkey no longer had any claim to previous Ottoman territory, including Cyprus. I believe this unrealistic expectation or aim led to Vulcan fading away in the preceding years that followed, and because the favourable position of British rule for the Turkish Cypriots remained. Yet, with the rise of the Ochre in 55, other underground Turkish Cypriot movements began sprouting. Fearful of a majority Greek Cypriot rule, as General Grievous's indiscriminate tactics were starting to affect all on the island. And as we previously mentioned, this meant the start of a division, physically, between Turkish and Greek Cypriots. The group that gained the most traction in the Turkish community was the Turkish Resistance Organization, established in 1957, known as TMT. It had one main aim, with two sub-aims, to raise awareness of the Cypriot issue to Turkey. This was so they could gain support to oppose EOKA and counter any demand for Enosis. And in the event of political division in Cyprus, TMT wanted something called Taksim in Turkish. Basically, they wanted a partition of the island between Greek and Turkish Cypriots. Now, reports are hazy in 1958 as to the clashes between EOKA and TMT. It is likely that generic pro-Enosis versus anti-Enosis riots have been labelled in hindsight as the former, but neither group really had that many members, so were certainly just inciting each ethnic community in their views, and they were stirring up the initial division between Greek and Turkish Cypriots by the natural divide that it was Greek Cypriots that wanted Enosis and Turkish Cypriots did not. What is clear in reports of the time is that intercommunal violence does significantly increase, regardless of how or what sparks it. In 1958 alone, there is 59 Greek Cypriot assassinations and 55 Turkish Cypriot assassinations reported, all attributed to EOKA and TMT, with no British connection established. So these are outright ethnically motivated, not crossfire or mass bombings, premeditated murder between once happy neighbours. It's now descending to anarchy. As the conflict on the streets continued, the British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, finally presents a political solution to Greece and Turkey, seeing them as the chief moderators of the Cypriot communities. This is known as the Macmillan Plan. It would see Cyprus ruled under a partnership with separate communal legislative bodies and separate municipalities for the majority Greek and Turkish Cypriots. The Greece and the Greek Cypriots outright reject the idea, claiming it's basically pandering to Taksim and it's partitioning the island. To them, it's not an option. Despite this, the talks continue. And in February 1959, after the decades of strife, the recent years of violent revolt and the continued oppression of Cypriot liberties, a compromise. It was agreed that the Macmillan Plan would be abandoned in substitution for a discussion on full independence. And here, the foundations, finally, for what is now the Republic of Cyprus. Makarios now returned from exile, where he had been a part of the Greek delegation in Zurich, where the talks took place. He attends the final rounds of discussions in London with the other representatives of Turkey and Greece. He is slightly standoff about the idea of independence, possibly under pressure from Grievous and others who are still adamantly pro-Enosis. But despite this, he does agree to ratifying of the Zurich-London Accords, as they become known. And these are the basis for the constitution of an independent Cyprus. They are the Treaty of Establishment, the Treaty of Guarantee, and the Treaty of Alliance. Incredible documents to look at today. Some frankly wacky ideas included on how to structure the island politically, and there is of course the issue of the British forces who want to remain. It's really the basis for why peace doesn't last, why the island is partitioned now, and why the British still have a foothold on the island. But that's for another episode. Next time, when we learn about how these early seeds of Cypriot division are going to grow into an international disaster requiring 60 years of United Nations presence on the island of Cyprus. Just before we end today's episode, a bit of bonus material. Some of you are probably wondering, what happened to Eoka? General Grievous and his band of merry men in the mountains, who effectively forced the political hand of the British to the negotiation table. Well, in short, Grievous, in reaction to the Macmillan plan, actually ordered his guerrilla fighters to increase attacks on British targets, resulting in the death of a further 8 civilians between October and December 1958, just weeks between the Zurich and London Accords being ratified. This, along with the recent rise in intercommunal violence, frustrated the population of Cyprus, which was actually getting the message that there was a possible imminent solution. Makarios himself also shifted away from affiliation with Eoka, showing that Eoka supports their support base was dwindling. And in the preceding months too, Eoka had been hunted in the mountains of Troodos and Carinya by thousands of paras and commando troops of the British forces. Although Grievous and other senior military leaders, they still managed to avoid detection despite this extensive efforts to find him. Despondent over not achieving Enosis in the end and seeing many of his fighters killed, imprisoned and now being ordered to ceasefire by Makarios, he eventually came out of hiding in March 1959 to find out that, as part of the agreement for independence from Britain, General Grievous was to be exiled from Cyprus, something I am sure would continue to grate between him and Makarios in the years to come. He returned to Greece, where he was heralded as the saviour of Greek Cypriots. He was awarded the highest military honours available, and he was paraded to the media and crowds of supporters. So that was the end of the Eoka, in the 1950s anyway. And it's important to note here that if you do any research yourselves, or if you're watching any documentaries on Cyprus, please don't get confused between Eoka and General Grievous of the 1950s and what happens later on, known as Eoka B. Now, I am not justifying by any stretch the actions of Grievous or his Eoka group in the 50s, but trying to be independent of the situation and comparing it to the atrocities that will be committed by Eoka B, we can make some argument for Eoka being the good Eoka. I say this in inverted commas, and not wanting to associate the two as being the same. I hope that makes some sense. It's a bit like comparing the IRB of the Easter Rising in 1916 with the later IRA of the Troubles post-1969. Linked, but not the same, and therefore possibly judged differently by history. In my analysis anyway, feel free to tell me if I'm wrong. So this is probably a good time to finish with a quote from Grievous himself, taken from his memoir. He stated, "During a lifetime devoted to the arts of war, I have fought 3 times with the British, 2 in world conflicts alongside them, and 1 in a struggle of my own making against them. History will vindicate my claim that on each occasion I was fighting for the same ideal, freedom." Thank you for listening to Cyprus Untold. If you would like any questions answered on the podcast, or you'd like to submit your supporting stories, photographs and memories of Cyprus throughout the ages, please message me direct on Instagram or YouTube at Cyprus Untold. Alternatively, send via email to info@ceasefire.world. Remember to like, subscribe and share wherever you get your podcast. For now, Oshikel and Dio. Goodbye.